From GPB News, this is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. If you believe in God, what do you think God looks like?
We bestow upon God not just all that is worthy in human nature, our capacity for love, our empathy and compassion, but all that is vile in it, our aggression and greed, our bias and bigotries, our penchant for extreme acts of violence.
That's theologian Reza Aslan. Today we talk with him about his new book, God, A Human History. First, though, we talked last week about how fewer than 1% of Southern Baptist churches are multi-ethnic.
The sort of ongoing racial tension that we have in America only highlights the fact that we need churches where we know one another and where we bear one another's burdens.
That's Reverend Russell Moore. He's president of the Southern Baptist Convention's Ethics and Religious Liberty Commission. Here are your first thoughts. Margaret McLean says, the Christian church is telling the world that the Holy Spirit cannot rid you of racist attitudes. Our present racial climate has finally revealed the hypocrisy of the church. White pulpits are not preaching against racism, and white families are keeping it alive at the dinner table. Anything you don't feed will die. Here are a couple more comments. The first is Reverend Ed Trufflesmith of Middle Georgia.
I'm a brand new minister in the Christian Church Disciples of Christ, and I'm actually starting to serve as a pastor for the first time. Moving to Alabama, in fact. I'm from Middle Georgia. But I'm going to serve a church that's almost all white. There are a few people of color. And our denomination as a whole is not real integrated, but it's very diverse as a church. We really do focus on racial reconciliation. It's an emphasis of our ministry right now.
This is Ed Miner from Savannah. Want to give a shout out to St. Paul's Episcopal Church in Savannah. We are about as multicultural and multi-ethnic and multi-idea as you can get.
According to a 2014 study from Pew Research, the most ethnically diverse religious groups in the U.S. are Seventh-day Adventists, Muslims, Jehovah's Witnesses, and Buddhists. We always love to get your thoughts. You can call us at 404-500-9457. We're also on Twitter at OST Talk. And remember, we might feature your comments on the show. The South has been a Republican stronghold since the days of Richard Nixon, but lately progressive candidates have begun to win state and local races. Birmingham, Alabama recently joined the list of southeastern cities, electing left-leaning African-American candidates. Randall Wolfen beat a two-term Democrat incumbent in a runoff election last month. Randall Wolfen joins me now. Good morning, sir.
Hey, good morning. How are you?
I'm doing well. Do you see a trend here, or do you think your election is about Birmingham alone?
I think it's both. I think what we're seeing in the South is in these urban cores, progressives are making a loud enough statement to say that how we're governing, it's not working, and the bench, as it relates to Democrats across the nation, has to start at the local level. So I believe it's both.
And in your case, we're not talking about defeating a Republican. We're talking about defeating another Democrat. What do you think made the difference?
I think it's rooted in not a message around helping people. I think when it boils down to governing, we have to be in a space of how we spend tax dollars and are we intentional about saying the people we want to represent, committed to improving their quality of life. I believe if incumbents are running for election and they haven't shown that they are actually helping people, it's hard to seek and retain your term. So for us, it was all about a message around people.
So you, I wonder what you make of some of the turmoil in the Democratic Party. I mean, we've heard a lot about the schisms in the Republicans, but the Democrats are going through some identity crises as well. What do you make of that? Do you think the party is changing?
Yes, the party's changing. One is that from a generational standpoint, things are changing. The voting block of 18 to 35, as well as 35 to 54, has something to say. And part of our conversation is we have to be more inclusive. We have to be intentional about an actual bench. If we want to be in the space of U.S. Senate races and U.S. congressional races and gubernatorial races, they don't come out of thin air. So it's important that the party toe the line as it relates to investing in every form of race, all the way down to school board races.
Since you mentioned age, I should mention I'm speaking with Randall Woodfin. He's mayor-elect of Birmingham, Alabama, and he is the youngest person elected to that office since 1893. You are 36, is that correct?
36, that's correct.
Did your age become an issue?
I think initially it did, and it was probably more so of, apparently, I'm not sure how a 36-year-old is supposed to look, but even at 36, apparently I don't look 36, so...
You have a young face. Let's say that. Do you get carded sometimes when you go and drink?
I definitely still get carded.
I wondered that myself. But you went to school in Morehouse, and I wonder what you think of sort of the political landscape of the South, and whether or not it's true that we're still struggling to motivate young people to get involved in politics.
We are, but I believe the struggle is centered, I think the struggle will always be centered around two things. Are we recruiting or finding and vetting viable candidates that know how to move people? And does that viable candidate have a message that resonates with people? If we do those two things, we can win any race we want.
Now, you were endorsed by Bernie Sanders in your race for mayor. Do you consider Bernie Sanders to be the kind of candidate you just mentioned, someone who can motivate young people?
Yeah, well, Bernie's definitely the top of that list. You know, I have the fortune that I was the state director of Alabama for Hillary Clinton race at HFA when she ran for president, but also in my mayoral race to be endorsed by Bernie. I would like to think that where I am in regards to my beliefs in the Democratic Party, hoping that I can be a bridge for all the different factions within the Big Tent. We have to come together. And what we have to say is there is a message that resonates with any type of Democrat that exists in America. It doesn't matter if they're black, white, generation, boomer, X, Y, young or old or other. There is a message for all of us to be behind. We just have to commit to that. And I don't know if that commitment level exists the way it needs to.
What message are you talking about? Because Bernie Sanders isn't a Democrat. He's an independent.
That's correct. The message is simple. As it relates to our policies and beliefs, and what we're fighting for, it has to be centered around people. You know, I think the Republican Party has done a masterful job in campaign messaging and bad at governing. And I think Democrats are really good at governing, and from a campaign standpoint, we don't get our message right. We have to do both. Our messaging has to be around what is our commitment to the people we say we want to represent. Are we actually fighting for people, and are we committed to them?
How do you bridge divides, though, with a South that is still largely right-leaning and conservative and Republican?
Well, I think you start with your base. Our base hasn't been motivated. So when you look at a state like Alabama, it's like a lot of states across America. You have your urban areas, you have your suburban areas, your ex-suburbia and rural. I think our base is centered around our urban areas. If you can't turn your base out, it's going to be hard to grow from there. So at a minimum, you have to commit to making sure your base is motivated to vote. From there, I think it's easy to grow. I tend to think that our suburban areas are not necessarily far right or far red. They're more on the slightly purple pinkish area, and that you can pull from that area if there's a message around here's what's in your interest as well.
You're young enough to still be pretty idealistic about politics. I don't mean that as an insult. I mean that as just a kind of a characterization and possibly a question, because even among millennials, even among people who are in their 20s, there is a cynicism and distrust of politics in the United States that is bipartisan.
That distrust is fair. We've gotten to a space where we allow anybody to run. We back candidates and put money behind people who we don't necessarily trust or have that good gut check and feeling about. I am idealistic, but I'm also pragmatic. I believe and know that if we have viable candidates with a credible message and we put some organizing efforts around them, they can beat candidates that shouldn't be there. and whether it's another Democrat or Republican, if we work hard enough around and support and push a viable candidate, we can win.
How do you work across the aisle? That's something that is becoming more and more rare, maybe not at the local level, but often at the national level. So how do are you still able to do that in the in these days of polarization?
You can. So at some point, the pendulum has to swing back to what works for all human beings, which is pragmatism, compromise, problem solving, and meeting people in the middle. You know, once everybody's sworn in, Democrats and Republicans, we represent all Americans. And so infrastructure investment nationwide shouldn't be a Democrat or Republican issue. It's an American issue. And that's just one example.
So you are an alum of Morehouse College, as I mentioned, and I wonder how you see the relationship of the city that you'll lead, Birmingham, with Georgia and with Atlanta, because there are a lot of connections. There are people, including one of my own colleagues, who commute back and forth. How do you view that relationship?
It can and will be better. We're about 2 hours out. Atlanta has a mayoral election tomorrow. There's a high chance there will be a runoff. When I look at Atlanta and I look at its progress, but even looking at Nashville and looking at other southern cities that are more progressive and more viable in industry and job recruitment, I'm looking at it from a best practices standpoint. There's a lot to learn from Atlanta, and I'm looking forward to working with the new mayor of the city of Atlanta.
So you are, at this point, the mayor-elect. What's the first thing you do when you take office?
It's going to center around making sure I've been in this position to hire from a talent acquisition standpoint, putting good, credible, strong people around me from a department head standpoint, as well as an administration standpoint, who know how to not just govern, but lead people and move teams. That would be the first thing.
And so before we end, since it is a voting day tomorrow for many people across the country, what would you say to young people who at this point aren't planning to vote?
You can't have it both ways. We tend to complain and not vote, or we vote and check out. I am asking every young voter to choose a third option. Not only vote, but hold those who you vote for accountable.
That is Mayor-elect of Birmingham, Alabama, Randall Woodfin. He is an alum of Morehouse College in Atlanta, and he'll take office on November 28th. Randall, thank you so much, and congratulations.
Hey, thank you.
Just ahead, if you could replace any body part, what would you choose? Would you choose, I should say, to become a cyborg? We're going to talk about engineering human anatomy. First, though, what we can learn from the race riots in Atlanta 110 years ago. This is On Second Thought. This is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. Very few people know there was a riot in Atlanta in 1906, during which whites murdered dozens of African Americans and wounded dozens more. But one Austrian novelist knew about it, and it was the finale of his novel, first published in 1922. The Blue Stain has now been translated into English for the first time, and Emory Professor Peter Hoying did the translation and joins us now. Good morning.
Good morning, Celeste.
The author of this novel, The Blue Stain, isn't all that well known in the United States. Who is he?
Well, he's not only not known in the United States, but he's really also not known in German-speaking territories. His name is Hugo Bettauer. He was born in 1872 outside of Vienna and was assassinated in 1925 for his liberal views in Vienna, and became, so to speak, the first Nazi victim of Austria.
Now, this novel, he was living in living in the United States, emigrated for some while, but he wasn't living in Georgia. How did he become aware? Do we know of the riots?
Yeah, let me first point out also and acknowledge my friend and former colleague, Jeff Meller. Both of us translated this novel. And in our subsequent research, we, so to speak, do a little bit of detective work and have a lot of dots but cannot connect them as of yet. It looks like that Bethauer must have known for certain W.E.B. Du Bois writings.
W.E.B. Du Bois, yeah.
Yeah, Du Bois writing. He must have been aware of the Atlanta race riot. But we don't have really sources to prove in which form he knew about it in Vienna in 1922. As you know, it took place in 1906, September 1906. What we found out recently is that he, for some reason, must have known Walter White's account or must have been aware of Walter White, who moved in 1918 to New York, coming from Atlanta and reporting much later than the novel on the race riots. But how we connected, we don't know for
not
sure
yet.
At this
we
point.
Connected
not
that
yet.
Dot. Correct. So tell me about the way that his novel describes the race riot, because he has a political point to make.
Oh, absolutely. It's a punching line at the very end, the very last paragraph. The novel is basically has three parts. The first part is called Georgia. And it begins with a botanist professor coming from Germany.
A mixed race professor.
No, he's blue, white, and everything.
Blue.
But he goes to a plantation of Mr. Wilcox, must be outside of Macon, and is shocked to find out the kind of rabid racism that he encounters there. Basically witnesses lynching, escapes with a girl, mulatto girl, and conceives the protagonist in Piedmont Park here in Atlanta. And then they move on to New York, but the mother dies in childbirth, and then we have Carletto, the main protagonist. In the second part, he is in Vienna growing up. It's a dandy life, playboy, hoity-toity lifestyle that he has. He cannot maintain it. And then we enter in the third part, basically back to the United States. He comes to New York and still has a little bit of money left and wants to continue his lifestyle of upper class and is going to the fanciest hotel only to find out that he's kicked out immediately because he, here in the States, in New York, he's conceived as black. And that continues. And in the end, he goes to Alabama. As you can tell, it's a real page-turner. There's a lot of things happening there. And Alabama and tries to save money to go back to Vienna, where he was conceived as someone basically of exotic Spaniard-looking type. And on the way from Alabama to back to Atlanta, he meets Jane Morris, who is an activist in the then NAACP movement and works for the Crisis. And she wants to recruit him. And he says, no, 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 no. I have faced too much of racism. I want to go back. It happens that the next day, the outbreak of the race riot happens, and that turns the events. And then the very last paragraph, he says, I'm one of yours. I will fight for the cause and against racism.
And he was, the author was quite concerned with anti-Semitism, but he, in this, he wanted to draw attention to how racist the United States was, which I wonder how you felt about reading that, given the fact that we're still talking about that.
Yeah, it was a real rediscovery. Basically, I was working on this novel for which he's still somewhat remembered today and best known, and that is called The City Without Jews. And that was published in the very same year. And in that novel, he basically shows how would it be if all of a sudden the political parties decide that all the Jews have to leave Vienna, basically a racist politics. Hugo Bethauer himself was an assimilated Jew and enjoyed for the first time the emancipation of Jews that were granted in 1867 in the Austro-Hungarian Empire. And here we go, and he is fully aware of anti-Semitism, and he makes basically a case of parallel that what the Jews had to face in Austria-Hungary, or all over Europe, I should say, now that can be compared to what blacks have to face and African Americans have to face in the United States.
That is Emory Professor of German Studies Peter Hoing. He and another colleague translated for the first time an early 20th century Austrian novel, The Blue Stain. It hit shelves earlier this year. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Celeste.
Maybe you saw the new Blade Runner last month, full of replicants, robotically engineered human beings. Science fiction, obviously, but it may not be that far into the future. A new book is called Bodybuilders: Inside the Science of the Engineered Human, and it looks at how scientists are learning to create bionic human body parts. And with me is the author, Adam Piore. Hello there.
Hi, Celeste. Thanks for having me.
This is a pretty optimistic book, I gotta say. You're talking about, and you use storytelling about people who have actually, in one way or another, replaced a body part, usually because there was an accident or something needed to occur. So let's start with the person you start with, which is Hugh Hare. He lost both his legs to frostbite while he was mountain climbing. Here's a little bit of his voice.
I began by developing specialized limbs that allowed me to return to the vertical world of rock and ice climbing. I quickly realized that the artificial part of my body is malleable, able to take on any form, any function, a blank slate for which to create perhaps structures that could extend beyond biological capability.
Are you making the case that his new limbs that he designed himself are better than his original limbs?
Oh, no, definitely not. But, it's just a great story, Hugh Hare. It's a great story of resilience and optimism. But, what he actually did is he was a champion rock climber and about a C and a D student in school. When he lost his limbs, he wandered into the wilderness and got frostbite, and both his limbs were amputated. And the doctors told him he'd never run or walk again or climb.
Or climb, yeah.
But what he did is he got on the climbing wall, and he was actually lighter than he had been before because he was missing his limbs. And he started messing with his prosthetics. So he made his prosthetics better for climbing, because he could make them any shape he wanted. So he made them, 7 feet long so he could reach holds. He made them 2 feet short with little blades that could go into crevices. And he could, soon he was a better climber than ever before. And he, was a subject of fascination. He was on 60 Minutes. He was on the cover of Outside Magazine and all these things and was world famous. He was already a great climber. But what happened is when he would come off the wall, he would realize that he would be profoundly disabled. And he was walking on these limbs, these basically a peg leg, which hadn't changed in a couple hundred years. And it was, chafing his skin and giving him, making him miserable. So he started tinkering with that. And he came with his prostheticist, he came up with a kind of a cushion and got a patent, but he also started taking classes and discovered an interest, a reason to pay attention in engineering. And he became a straight A student. And then he got into MIT. And now he's a leading prosthetics engineer. Now, I don't think his limbs yet are better than the real thing because we haven't yet connected them to the nervous system. So you can't move them just by thinking. You kind of have to push on them. But it's remarkable what he was able to accomplish. And really, I sort of fell into this rabbit hole of this over the last 10 years through this story. I mean, an incredible story of human resilience. He used to wake up in the morning and he'd be dreaming about running through the field behind his parents' house with the wind blowing in his hair. And then he'd wake up to the stumps of his legs and start crying. His doctors told him he'd never run again. Now he jogs every day. But what this is an example of is we now have the sensing and computational power to figure out how the constituent parts of the leg move and work together to create movement. And he's actually made robotic parts that emulate what they do.
So this is all part of bioengineering. What is included in bioengineering? I mean, if you get a knee replacement, is that bioengineering?
It depends. But yeah, I think so. It's basically engineers are turning their sights inward, right? In the last century, we sent people to the moon. We built new kinds of vehicles. We built skyscrapers. Now we sort of have the resolution to look inward and to decode how the constituent parts of the body move and work together and to build replacement parts. and to sort of hack the system. So that's what I was looking at. I mean, it's not all bioengineering in here, but a lot of it is. Yeah. It's basically engineering biology. So I looked at regenerative medicine, where we're figuring out how stem cells work, how they respond to their environment, and how we can, you know, try and regrow parts of the body that have been lost, you know, muscle, bone. People are trying to regrow limbs. That's going to be a while. We're talking about genetic engineering, which is
messing with the DNA code,
right? And brain-computer interfaces. You know, all sorts of things. It all has to do with just decoding the way the body works and finding ways to fix broken parts and possibly upgrade it.
And one of the things that you discuss in the book is the ethics of augmentation. What kind of work is being done on finding that line? That ethical line.
Well, let's see. What is being done? I mean, there's a lot of talk.
Right, exactly. but it doesn't sound like there's a whole lot of... It sounds like each person is sort of making that up as for themselves.
Well, I mean, you know, we're not there yet. I mean, the most controversial part is genetic engineering, right? That's what I think we have to worry about. And, you know, we're just beginning. We have, you know, however many nucleotides, I forget, 2 or 3 billion nucleotides, we don't have the computational power to understand how they all work together, most of these traits, and how they interact with the environment for most of the things that make us who we are, right? And, you know, some of the first genetic engineering therapies have been approved in the last couple of years, but they're for very basic things, one gene diseases. And what I found is that a lot of the stories that I wrote, I mean, I went in thinking, this could be dystopian, this could be scary. But what I found is what's driving a lot of this research is the desire to help people who've lost things. And that's really where it's making an impact. I didn't see any examples of abuse of this yet. You know, it's all about people who, like Hugh Herr, who couldn't walk and couldn't run and now can run again. There's a woman in there with an incredible story who can see with her ears. And she was able to gaze upon a mountaintop and started crying again, you know, crying because she was so happy. And you know, there's a local guy here who was locked in and, you know, he was trying to be able to communicate with his kids. And so that's what's really driving the money for this. Sure, there's plenty of ethical considerations that are going to come up, and we'll deal with them as they come up. Some of these things have been derailed in the past. I have a chapter on deep brain stimulation, and that is being used to treat people with Parkinson's, but also with depression and obsessive compulsive disorder. And they're looking at ways to treat other things. And in fact, there's a famous local person named Helen Mayberg at Emory who does research on deep brain stimulation and depression. But a lot of experimenting with electrodes in people's brains was derailed for a while because it was so controversial and because there were abuses in the 70s and 80s. A much more crude way of interacting, but there was congressional hearings and it sort of fell out of favor. And so people are very careful now.
There is, though, I mean, you spoke earlier about the fact that we haven't quite been able to connect these artificial limbs to the nervous system. But we have started to be able to see advances in, say, the human brain, a human being able to control a computer with their mind. How long do you think we get before those two sort of technologies merge and we're able to use the mind to control a limb?
Well, actually, we have been able to do that in the lab. There's a locked-in woman, a quadriplegic woman who was able to control a robotic arm and actually use it to eat chocolate. And she was able to high-five her, you know,
so
her doctors.
So the important stuff first.
Yeah. but as somebody said to me, he said, until you could drive a wheelchair safely in traffic using your mind or on the edge of a cliff, it's not going to come out of the lab. And the fact is that you could control movement of a wheelchair if you're locked in with your eyes or with a joystick much more... you don't want to get invasive brain surgery when you can use a joystick to move something. You know what I mean? So until it increases, until we find less invasive ways, but also until the resolution and accuracy of these things increase, they're going to stay in the lab. But we are pushing that. And now there's a guy at University of Pittsburgh named Andy Schwartz, who's the one who worked with this woman who was able to feed herself chocolate with a robotic arm, and he's now working on the sensory cortex, which is sending signals back the other way so that, you know, the robotic arm you can have
touch
a sense of touch.
And know if it's hot.
Yeah. So they're doing this. It's just, it's sort of like, you know, the initial IBM computers or something. You know, these are prototypes that aren't commercial yet. But I mean, our understanding is improving in leaps and bounds. It's pretty astounding, and you know, that's what this book is about.
And you do a good job of having real life examples of people for most of the science that you're talking about. This is Adam Piore, author of the new book Bodybuilders: Inside the Science of the Engineered Human. He appears for a book signing at the Marcus Jewish Community Center of Atlanta today at noon. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Just ahead, one of the most progressive scholars of religion has a little news for you about God. This is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. This is On Second Thought. This fall marks 25 years since Athens' own REM put out the iconic album Automatic for the People. Night swimming deserves a quiet night. We will mark that music milestone by talking with REM bass player Mike Mills this week. Be sure to join us for that conversation. First, though, we want to hear from you if you're an REM fan. What is your favorite song? It doesn't have to be the best song, just your favorite and why you like it. Tell us at 404-500-9457, and then be sure to join us this week for that conversation. Most people imagine God looks basically human. That idea is in the first chapter of the Old Testament's first book.
So God created man in his own image.
In his own image. That is from Genesis. A new book by Ressa Aslan challenges that idea and the morality it produces. The book is called God, A Human History. It hits shelves this week, and Ressa appears in Atlanta this Saturday as part of the Marcus Jewish Community Center's Book Festival and joins me now. Hi, Ressa.
Hi, Celeste.
It's good to talk to you. And you know, I wonder, let's just start with the fact that every book that you put out, people label as controversial. Can you write about religion without being controversial?
Well, not really. I mean, that's the thing. I think people think that I'm somehow courting controversy, and I promise you that I'm not. It's just that when you talk and write about religion for a living, you're bound to step on some toes. I mean, people tend to take religion seriously. I'm not sure if you know that or not. And also, when you talk about it in the way that I do, which is try to bring some kind of a historical lens upon it, to really try to look at scripture and tradition and religious history from an objective perspective, you tend to anger both sides of the aisle, both those who are very religious, who feel as though you are denying the divine quality of their faith, and those who are anti-religious, who think that you're taking religion too seriously. So, you know, it's something that I'm used to, I guess, at this point.
Well, certainly, before we dig into the current book, let's talk about your former book and the TV interview that went viral. It was on Fox in 2013. This is from Spirited Debate. The host was Lauren Green.
You're a Muslim, so why did you write a book about the founder of Christianity?
Well, to be clear, I am a scholar of religions with 4 degrees, including one in the New Testament and fluency in biblical Greek, who has been studying the origins of Christianity for 2 decades, who also just happens to be a Muslim.
I have a feeling that that's going to be like stamped on my gravestone one day.
Well, it did bring you a lot of attention, right? I mean, your publisher was probably pretty happy.
Yeah.
But I wonder, I mean, that's not something, scholars don't often have to defend their own credentials.
Yeah, it's weird. You know, like no one would say to say, let's say, you know, a Monet scholar with a German heritage, how dare you study French Impressionism?
Yeah.
you know?
Right.
But again, religion is a different thing because, yes, of course, it is an academic discipline to be studied. But it is also a matter of identity. It's how people define who they are and their place in the world. And so obviously it's a matter of deep devotion and emotion. And again, you know, it comes with the whole category. It's what happens when you deal with something that is so emotionally resonant for people.
So since you're talking about identity, that brings us very nicely to the current book, which is called God, A Human History. And you start by just laying out the fact that pretty much every religion, in fact, every human being, if they believe in God, they tend to think of God as being looking like a human. And in most cases, like an older male. Why do we do that?
Well, not just if you believe in God, but even if you don't believe in God. It's often the case that, you know, when someone will say, well, I don't believe in God, you have to ask them a far more important question, which is, what do you mean by God? And often what they mean is, an old man living in the sky, looking down at us, punishing us for the wrong things that we do. And I always have to say that I don't believe in that God either. And in fact, if anything else, what I'm really trying to do with this book is to get past that simple polarization of do you or do you not believe in God and get to a much more fundamental question, which is what do you mean when you say God? And what the evidence suggests is that more often than not, consciously or not, whether we believe in God or not, what the vast majority of us mean when we say God is a divine version of ourselves, a human being, but with superhuman powers.
So, and in the very early pages, I think it's even in your introduction, you talk about why that's problematic. You say even the fact that we think of God as reflecting ourselves, I want to read this sentence here, that more than anything else explains why throughout human history, religion has been a force both for boundless good and for unspeakable evil.
Yeah.
What does that mean?
I mean, think about it. When we conceive of God as a divine version of ourselves, what we do is we essentially divinize our own attributes, our own personalities. We project upon God our traits, our virtues and our vices, our strengths and our weaknesses. We make God essentially a reflection of everything that is good or bad about us. We impose upon God our compassion, our thirst for justice, but we also impose upon him our prejudices, our biases. We essentially make God the mirror of everything that we are, everything that we love, everything that we hate. And in doing so, we create this kind of superhuman being who has human attributes, but without any human limitations. And it's not a surprise, therefore, that this kind of mindset leads to these irreconcilable religious conflicts that have roiled our world, really, ever since there was any such thing as religion.
And the book is very careful in laying out the fact that you're not just talking about Islam, you're not just talking about Christianity, you're pretty much talking about every religious faith. And I want to go back to the connection you make to cave paintings. Now, cave paintings, we don't entirely know what they mean or what the artists were depicting. You feel as though some of these cave paintings, very, very old ones, were the first image of God. What led you to believe that?
Well, there's an enormous amount of archaeological and anthropological evidence to indicate that these magnificent cave paintings, which certainly dot the landscape of Europe and Asia, but exist, you know, as far afield as Australia and Indonesia. Some of them are actually here in North America, though they're much newer than the European and the Asian ones, that they are expressions of prehistoric spirituality, that they're not just, you know, caveman graffiti, if you will, but that they are representing a prehistoric sense of that which lies beyond the material realm. And you know, a lot of this argument that I'm making actually has to do with the way that the very concept of God evolved in human spirituality. You're right. It's not just about Christianity, Islam, and Judaism. In fact, this conception, the humanization of the divine, goes back to before there was any such thing as religion. It's a function of our brains. And so in the book, I delve real deeply into the cognitive processes through which the very idea of God arose. And when you look at that evidence, that evolutionary evidence, what you find is essentially that we have no choice in the matter, that when we conceive of God, when we try to think of something that is, you know, by definition, so beyond human experience, there is no other way to make sense of that thing without making it human. And so I present the entire history of human spirituality going back some 500,000 years to today as one long, intimately linked, and remarkably cohesive attempt to make sense of the divine by progressively humanizing the divine until, of course, in the person of Jesus Christ, God literally becomes a human being.
And it's funny you mention evolution and cognitive science because you do a kind of a clever thing, and I think this is fairly early on. Adam and Eve, you see them as Homo sapiens. They're not the only people on the planet. You're sort of telling the story of human evolution and development, but adding these two biblical characters, Adam and Eve, in there. And you even sort of imagine them putting their handprints on one of the French cave paintings.
Right. Well, you know, what I'm trying to do is kind of flip the script a little bit and challenge some of the perceptions that we have. I mean, you know, many people accept the biblical notion that Adam and Eve were sort of the first of our species. And so what I say was, okay, let's assume that Adam and Eve were the first of our species. What would they have actually been like? How would they have dressed? What would they have eaten? How would they have thought of the divine? And so I make Adam and Eve our kind of prototypical Homo sapien ancestors. And I take the reader on a journey with Adam and Eve through their lives, through their spiritual lives. Yes, I follow them into one of these magnificently painted caves, these subterranean sanctuaries that were, in my reading certainly, and in many scholars' readings, an expression of prehistoric spirituality, the first religious expression, if you will. And I basically use them as a means of explaining to the reader what that kind of ancient spiritual life would have felt like and how we have evolved since then. And then at the end of the book, I think I make a compelling argument for why we should maybe go back to
pantheism.
That prehistoric sense of spirituality, devoid of the kind of institutional religiosity that has in many way captured our spiritual imaginations.
I'm speaking with religious scholar Reza Aslan. He's the author of Zealot, The Life and Times of Jesus of Nazareth, but his latest book is called God, A Human History, and it comes out Wednesday. So then let's talk about what you just mentioned, which is this argument for pantheism. At what point did the major religions, at least, become monotheistic? At what point, I mean, because you address this in the book and it is a subject of debate, when did Judaism, for example, become monotheistic?
Well, you know, this is one of the most fascinating aspects of this history of God conversation. You know, there's a lot of debate about how far back religious expression can go. You know, I date it to at least 500,000 years, if not more. I mean, I actually think that it's just part of our evolution. It's embedded in our DNA. It's a mode of knowing. It's how our brains evolved. So I take it back even further than that. But if you're talking about material evidence, things that we can dig up that say, oh, this looks like it may have been for religious reasons, yeah, you can go back about 500,000 years. So in those 500,000 years, what we call monotheism, that is the belief in a sole singular God and no other gods, is 3,000 years old. And the question is why? Now, it's not that monotheism didn't arise in our spiritual history. It did. It's just that when it did arise, it was very quickly denied or rejected, sometimes violently so. It took a long time for monotheism to finally take root, and it took root in Judaism first and foremost. And it didn't take root in Judaism until during what is often referred to as the Babylonian exile, so about 586 BC. And part of the reason for that, the argument that I make in the book, is simply goes back to this humanization impulse. See, we're okay with implanting certain of our characteristics upon the gods. So we have one god that represents our emotional love. We have one god that represents our quest for violence and warfare. But the idea that all of our attributes, all of our human personalities, every aspect of who we are can reside in a single god was something that the ancient mind simply couldn't comprehend. Why would one god be responsible for both good and evil? Why would one god be responsible for the sun and the moon, for the sky and the earth? It just didn't compute in the ancient mind. And it took an existential crisis, which is what the Jews were facing when they were destroyed by the Babylonians and scattered into exile. It took an existential crisis to finally force the spiritual mind into this conception of a singular God. I tell that story in detail in the book, but in general, I think it's just an extraordinary thing to think about, that this notion of one God is such a new idea in the history of human spirituality.
And we only have a minute left, but I do want to ask you, why would pantheism then, separating that out again, removing the sort of human image of God, why would that make us kinder, gentler people?
Well, look, pantheism, for those of you who aren't familiar with it, is essentially the belief that God is all and all is God, that God is not the creator of the universe. God is the universe, that there can be no distinction between creator and creation. It's an idea that has been around since the beginning, and it exists almost in all religious traditions. But what it does is that it forces you to realize that you and the world around you is divine. It changes the your relationship with other people, with people of other religions, people of other ethnicities. It changes your relationship to the world and how you think about it. If the entire universe is infused with the divine, then in a sense, if you're a worshipful person, you are worshiping the universe and all of creation. It leads to a much more pluralistic, much more peaceful, and in my view, much deeper and more meaningful spirituality.
That's Reza Aslan. His latest book is God, A Human History. He appears this Saturday in Atlanta, 8 p.m. in Zevon Park as part of the Marcus Jewish Community Center's Book Festival. Thank you so much.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
That's a show for today, but we would love to hear from you. When I say the word God, what image comes into your head? Describe what you mean by that three-letter word. You know how to reach us? Call us at 404-500-9457, or you can post on Facebook or Twitter. For today, that's on Second Thought from GPB News. I'm Celeste Headlee. Have a great day.